historical release, and then only at the widely scattered last remains of the pre-interlaced public art film theaters in arty places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Berkeley, California. And Interlace never considered it for pulse order re-release for obvious reasons. The art film theater's marquees and posters and ads for the thing were all required to say something like, "The joke. You are strongly advised not to shell out money to see this film." Which art film habitués, of course, thought was a cleverly ironic anti-ad joke. And so they'd shell out for little paper theater tickets and file in their sweater vests and tweeds and dirndls and tank up on espresso at the concession stand and find seats and sit down and make those little pre-movie leg and posture adjustments and look around with that sort of vacant intensity. And they'd figured the tri-lensed Bolex H32 cameras, one held by a tall, stooped old guy and complexly mounted on the huge head of the oddly forward-listing boy with what looked like a steel spike coming out of his thorax, the big cameras down by the red-lit exit signs on either side of the screen, the patrons figured, were there for like an ad or an anti-ad or a behind-the-scenes metafilmic documentary or something. That is, until the lights went down and the film started up, and what was on the wide public screen was just a wide-angled, binoculated shot of this very art film theater's audience filing in with espressos and finding seats and sitting down and looking around and getting adjusted and saying knowledgeable little pre-movie things to their thick-lensed dates about what the don't-pay-to-see-this-ad and Bolex cameras probably signified artistically, and settling in as the lights dimmed and facing the screen, that is, now themselves, it turns out, with the coolly excited smiles of highbrow entertainment expectation. Smiles which the cameras and screens projection now revealed as just starting to drop from the faces of the audience, as the audience saw row after row of itself staring back at it with less and less expectant and more blank, and then puzzled, and then eventually pissed off facial expressions. The joke's total running time was just exactly as long as there was even one cross-legged patron left in the theater to watch his own huge projected image, gazing back down at him with a special distaste of a disgusted and ripped-off feeling art film patron, which ended up being more than maybe 20 minutes only when there were critics or film academics in the seats, who studied themselves, studying themselves, taking notes with endless fascination, and finally left only when the espresso finally impelled them to the loo, at which point himself and Mario would have to frantically pack up cameras and lens cases and coaxials and run and totter like hell to catch the next cross-country flight from Cambridge to Berkeley or Berkeley to Cambridge, since they obviously had to be there all set up and Bolexed for each showing at each venue. Mario said Lyle had said Incandenza had confessed that he'd loved the fact that the joke was so publicly static and simple-minded and dumb, and that those rare critics who defended the film by arguing at convolved length that the simple-minded stasis was precisely the film's aesthetic thesis were dead wrong, as usual. It's still unclear whether it was the eyeball and sideshow thing, or the Medusa versus, or the joke that had metamorphosized into their late father's later involvement with the hostilely anti-real genre of found drama, which was probably the historical zenith of self-consciously dumb stasis, but which audiences never actually even got to hate for a priori reasons. "Freak Statue of Liberty accident kills Fed engineer." Better. "Brave man on crane crushed by 5-ton cast-iron burger." 12-point subheader. "Gentle promises skeptical Cub Scout convention. You'll be able to eat right off territorial U.S. by end of term's first year." Header. "Another love canal?" 24-point superheader. "Toxic horror accidentally uncovered in upstate New Hampshire." 16-point header-sized subheader.
"New Hampshire environmental officials yesterday flatly denied that vast collections of drums leaking industrial solvents, chlorides,
benzenes, and auxins had been, quote, stumbled on by 18 federal EPA staffers playing a casual game of softball east of Berlin, New Hampshire, claiming instead that the corroded receptacles had been placed there against statute by large men with white bodysuits and short haircuts in long, shiny trailer trucks with ONAN's official crest, a sombreroed eagle with a maple leaf in its mouth stenciled on the sides. In the nation's capital, a, quote, full and energetic investigation has been promised by the General Administration into claims by residents of Berlin, New Hampshire, and Rumford, Maine, that the incident of soft-skulled and extra-eyed newborns in the toxically affected area far exceeds the national average. $3.75 U.S. Nightly Rental News Cartridge Anchor Lead. Sub Rosa, fusion in poisonous environment test site alleged at Montpelier, Vermont. Scientific North American Header. My baby has six eyes and basically no skull. Lurid color, 32-point tabloid header. Dateline, Lancaster, New Hampshire. Fed EPA softballers allege two more poisonous waste horror fest illegal dump sites stumbled over near North Syracuse. Historic Ticonderoga. New York City Daily Header. The fine art of federal stumbling. A whole lot of softball going on. Editorial header in Syracuse, New York's Post Standard. Canadian Prime Minister denies secret miniature golf outing with outraged New England governors. Surprisingly small third page, 10-point header. Gentle shocker. Pearl Harbor-sized 32-point, super-super header, almost too big to read clearly. Mayflower, Red Bull, Allied, U-Haul stocks soar. 16-point financial daily subheader. Two Northeast governors hospitalized for infarction, aneurysm. 10-point subheader. Gentle declares all U.S. territory north of line from Syracuse to Ticonderoga, New York, Ticonderoga, New York to Salem, Massachusetts, federal disasters, offers federal aid for upstate and New England residents wishing to relocate, claims funds for EPA cleanup are not within the map of what's possible. Header from chemically over-garrulous headliner eventually fired, even from subheader department, for exceeding verbal parameters and now starting to get in the same hot water all over again at a much less prestigious daily paper. And so on, and so forth. Himself's old optical editing lab has imposing CompuGraphic typesetting and matting facilities. It's hard to tell which of the headlines and other stuff are for real, and which have been dickied with, usually, if you're too young to recall the actual chronology. At least some of the headlines are phony, the kids know. Miniature golf, indeed. But the accuracy of Mario's puppeteered account of the seminal meeting of what's come to be known as the Concavity Cabinet gets to stand uncontested by fact. Nobody who wasn't actually there at the 16th of January meeting knows just what was said when or by whom, the General Administration being of the position that extant Oval Office recording equipment was a veritable petri dish of organisms. Gentle's clack of doo-wopping Motown cabinet puppets have purple dresses and matching lipstick and nail polish and bouffants so blindingly afro-sheened that there had been special lighting and film speed problems in the custodial closet. Secretary of the Treasury. You're looking vigorous and hale today, sir. Gentle. Presidente of Mexico, Secretary of Mexico, Vice Chair ONAN. May I ask, senor, why my distinguished co-vice chair of ONAN is not with us in attendance today? Gentle. Mr. Rodney Tyne, Chief, U.S. Office of Unspecified Services.
The President's taking a little pure oxygen today, boys, and has authorized me as his oral proxy on this, may I say, historically opportune day. The Canadian PM's in a bit of a snit. He prefers to whinge in the media, surrounded by mounted reserves,
and is off somewhere far from Quebec in a Kevlar vest doing whatever the Canadian word is for pouting, doubtless poring over opinion polls prepared by chinless guys in Canadian horn rims. Mexico and some other secretaries. Various puzzled, apprehensive noises. Tyne.
I'm sure you've all been briefed on the unprecedented but not unopportune crisis that obtains north of the almost perfectly horizontal line between Buffalo and northeast Massachusetts.
Tyne arranges photos on seal-crested easels. A New Hampshire runoff ditch running off stuff a color nobody's quite ever seen before. A wide-angle horizon-stretching vista of skull-embossed drums, with short-haired guys in white bodysuits walking around adjusting knobs and reading dials on shiny handheld devices. A very weird chemical sunrise, close in hue to the cabinet member's lipstick, over some forests in southern Maine that look way taller and generally lusher than January forests ought properly to be. A couple indoor-lit snapshots of a multi-eyed infant crawling backwards, its ear to the carpet, dragging its shapeless head like a sack of spuds. The last displays a real heartstring plucker. All secretaries. Various concerned and sympathetic noises. Gentle. Tyne.
Gentlemen, let the President just say that no one's prepared to say they're quite sure what's happened, or just which quote-unquote loyal part of the union or organization might reasonably be said to be culpable. But it's not the administration's immediate concern to point the leveling finger of blame or aspersion just yet or right now. Our concern is to act, to respond, and act and respond decisively, swiftly and decisively.
Secretary of the Interior.
We've come up with some extremely preliminary projections on the cost of detoxifying and or deradiating the better part of 4 U.S. states, sir. And I have to tell you, gentlemen, that even with the atmosphere of uncertainty at this point in time of not yet having a definitive handle on just what kinds of combinations of compounds were, found there and how wide your, not your personally, sir, J.G., your just being a shorthand way for, to say something like, I suppose, simply the... how wide the dispersal and toxicity parameters are shaping up to look, I have to relate that the figures we're looking at are almost staggeringly multi-zeroed, sir, gentlemen.
Tyne.
Tighten in and expand on staggering, if you will, Blaine.
Secretary of the Interior.
We're talking, at bare minimum, a staggering amount of private sector caliber guys in white suits and helmets, not unlike your own helmet, sir, with a commensurately massive tab for the suits and helmets. Plus gloves and throwaway booties and a lot of really shiny equipment with a great many knobs and dials, sir.
Gentle.
Tyne. Gentlemen, let's pay the President the due tribute of proceeding right to the bone of the matter. I think the President's position is rendered patently clear by the pure oxygen he's been forced to take here with us today. No way we can possibly permit territory publicly exposed as this befouled and waste-impacted to continue to besmirch the already tight and tidier territory of a new era's U.S. of A.
The President shudders at the mere thought. Just the mere thought of it forces him to resort to oxygen. Presidente of Mexico, Secretary of Mexico, and Vice Chair of ONAN.
I do not anticipate what options your federal and our continental government might consider options to this permitting, signors.
Other secretaries. Tentative, puzzled nods and slightly off-key agreement noises.
Tyne. Having been elected and conferred with a mandate on the clear and publicly anti-waste platform of the cusp, the President is inexorably driven to see the only viable option being to give it away.
Secretary of State.
Give it away?
Tyne.
Expressly.
Secretary of State.
You mean simply tell the truth? That Johnny's cuss platform necessitates, given the unfeasibility of shooting national wastes into space, since NASA hasn't put a successful launch on in over a decade, and the rockets simply fall over and blow up and become more waste, that, given the amount of additional waste annular fusions startup is going to start putting in circulation the minute startup commences, that his platform all but necessitates the second-tier option of transforming certain vast stretches of U.S. territory into uninhabitable and probably barbed-wired landfills and fly-shrouded dumps and saprogenic magenta-fogged toxic disposal sites? Concede publicly that those EPA softball games weren't casual or hiccup in the least? That you allowed Rod the God here to convince you to authorize unspecified services to undertake massive toxic dumping and skull softening against local statute for basically the same hard choice? Greater good of the Union reasons that prompted Lincoln to suspend the Constitution and jail Confederate activists without charge for the duration of the last great U.S. territorial crisis?
156.
And, or not least, that these particular territories were chosen essentially because New Hampshire and Maine didn't let cusp on their independent ballots, and the mayor of Syracuse had the misfortune to sneeze on the president during a campaign swing? Give away the entire strategy the two of you have apparently huddled in some sterilized corner and mapped out? Can't this be what you mean by give it away, Rod?
Don't be a moron, Billingsley. The it in the president's give it away signifies the territory.
Gentle.
Ha ha ha.
Tyne.
We're going to give away the whole benighted smirch of ground.
Secretary of the Interior.
Export it, one might venture to sally.
Tyne.
It's a novel and proactive resource no prior statesman's had the vision or environmental cojones to envision. If there's one natural resource we've still got in spades, it's territory.
Presidente of Mexico, Secretary of Mexico, Vice Chair O.N.A.N., and several other secretaries attempt to bring eyebrows back down below hairlines. Tyne.
President Gentles decided we're going to reinvent not just government but history. Torch the past. Manifest a new destiny. Boys, we're going to institute some serious intra-O.N.A.N. interdependence.
Gentle.
Ha 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 ha.
Tyne.
Gentlemen, we're going to make an unprecedented, intercontinental gift of certain newly expendable Northeast American territories in return for the foot de mieux continuation of U.S. waste displacement access to those territories. Allow me to illustrate what the president means.
Tyne places two large maps, also courtesy of Ms. Heath's crafts class, on government-issue easels. They look both to be of the good old USA. The first map is your more or less traditional standard issue, with the U.S. looking really big and white, and Mexico's northern fringes a tasteful ladies' room pink, and Canada's brooding bottom hem a garish, almost menacing red. The second North American map looks neither old nor all that good, traditionally speaking. It has a concavity. It looks sort of like some person or persons have taken a deep, wicked, canine-intensive bite out of its upper right bit, in which an ascending and then descending line has its near right angle at what looks to be the historic and now hideously befouled Ticonderoga, New York, and the areas north of that jagged line look to be that pushy shade of Canadian red now. Some little rubber practical joke type flies, the blue-bellied kind that live on filth, are stapled in a raisin-esque dispersal over the red concavity. Tyne has a trademark telescoping weatherman's pointer that he plays with instead of using to point at much of anything. Secretary of State.
A kind of, ecological gerrymandering?
Tyne.
The President invites you, gentlemen, to conceive these two visuals as a sort of before-and-after representation of projected intra-ONAN territorial reallocations, or some public term like that. Redemisement's probably too technical.
Secretary of State.
Still respectfully not quite sure we at State see how inhabited territories can be sold to the public as, quote, expendable, when a decent slice of that public, by all reports, inhabits that territory, Rod.
Gentle.
Ha 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 ha.
Tyne.
The president's proactively chosen not to hedge that high-cost, tough-choice, possibly unpopular
Lonely at the top, fact one bit, guys. We've been moving forward full bore on anticipating various highly involved relocation scenarios. Scenario? Is it scenarios or scenario?
157.
Marty's on task on the scenario front. Care to bring us to speed, Marty?
Secretary of Transportation.
We foresee a whole lot of people moving south really, really fast. We foresee cars, light trucks, heavier trucks, buses, Winnebagoes, Winnebago? Commandeered vans and buses and possibly commandeered Winnebagoes or Winnebago. We foresee four-wheel drive vehicles, motorcycles, jeeps, boats, mopeds, bicycles, canoes, and the odd makeshift raft. Snowmobiles and cross-country skiers and roller skaters on those strange-looking roller skates with only one line of wheels down each skate. We foresee backpack-type folks speed-walking in walking shorts and boots and Tyrolean hats and a stick. We foresee some folks just outright running like hell, possibly, Rod. We foresee homemade wagons piled high with worldly goods. We foresee BMW war surplus motorcycles with sidecars and guys in goggles and leather helmets. We foresee the occasional skateboard. We foresee a strictly temporary breakdown in the thin veneer of civilization over the souls of essentially frightened, stampeding animals. We foresee looting, shooting, price gouging, ethnic tensions, promiscuous sex, births in transit.
Secretary of Hugh.
Rollerblades, I think you mean, Marty.
Secretary of Transportation.
All feedback and input welcome, Trent. Someone junior in the office foresaw hang gliders. I don't foresee demographically significant hang gliding personally at this juncture. Nor, I need to stress, do we foresee anything you could call true refugees.
Gentle. Tyne.
Absolutely not, Mart. No way a downer association rife term like refugees is going to be applicable here. I cannot overstress this too assertively. Eminent non-domain, yes. Renewal grade brand of sacrifice, you bet. Heroes? New era's breed of new pioneers? Striking in bravely for already settled, good old, settled but unfoul American territory? Bien, sir.
Secretary of State.
Bien, sir.
Press Secretary, with queer combination of bangs and bouffant, and pair of bifocals on slim bead chain around neck and resting in cleavage.
Neil over in Spin has been poring through resource materials. Apparently, the term refugee can be plausibly denied if both, I'm quoting directly from Neil's memo here, if both A, no homemade wagons piled high with worldly goods are pulled by slow bovine animals with curvy horns, and B, if the percentage of children under six who are either A, naked, or B, squalling at the top of their lungs, or C, both, is under 20% of the total number of children under six in transit. It's true that Neil's key resource here is Paul and Yang's Totalitarian's Guide to Iron-Fisted Spin. But they're thinking this fact can be spun away from without much to do, over in Spin.
Gentle. Tyne.
Marty and Jay's staffs have been day and nighting on strategies to forestall anything like ostensible refugeeism.
Press Secretary, holding brilliantined head at that angle people in bifocals have to read.
Anything bovine with curvy horns gets shot on sight. Rod's top USO operatives in shiny trucks at strategic intervals handing out free toddlerware courtesy of Sears' Winnie the Pooh line to nip nakedness in the bud.
Secretary of the Treasury.
Still hammering out the boilerplate on the Sears agreement, Rod.
Tyne.
The President has every confidence, Chet. I believe Marty and Jay were just getting to the transportational coup de grace.
Secretary of Transportation.
We're soliciting bids for signs up there, making it legal to drive really, really fast in the breakdown lanes.
Press Secretary.
Southbound breakdown lanes.
All secretaries. Harmonic murmurs. Secretary of State.
Still, I don't see why not just retain
cartographic title to the toxified areas. Relocate citizenry and portable capital. Use them as our own designated disposal area. Sort of the back of the hall closet or special wastebasket underneath the national kitchen sink, as it were. Hammer out systems for delivering all national refuse and waste into the area. Cordon it off. Keep the rest of the nation edible off, as per Johnny's platform.
Secretary of Hugh. Why cede vitally needed waste disposal resources to a recalcitrant ally? Tyne.
Billingsley. Trent. And yet, who, as I stated, says we can't utilize these territories for just this purpose, no matter whose nation's name they're in? Interdependence is, as interdependence does, after all.
Presidente of Mexico, Secretary of Mexico, Vice Chair O.N.A.N.
Okay?
Gentle. Tyne.
Yet Billingsley's right that this kind of sprawling, depopulated, newly Canadian territory can accommodate the tidiness needs of the whole Great Continental Alliance for decades to come. After that, look out, Yukon!
Presidente of Mexico, Secretary of Mexico, Vice Chair O.N.A.N. Face green and mask wetly dark over upper lip.
May I respectfully ask Presidente Yento, how are you proposing to ask my newly succeeded co-vice chair of our continental organization to possibly be able to accept vast arenas of egregiously poisoned terrain on behalf of his peoples?
Tyne.
Valid question. Simple answer. Three answers. Statesmanship. Gamesmanship.
Counting now on fine, strong, white, clean fingers.
Brinksmanship.
With now more, and rather more jejune, journalistic FX spinning out of the black at high camp speeds to a 45 RPM playing of Custodian Dave, FDV, Hardy's, 1/3 RPM disc of Flight of the Bumblebee.
Gentle to Canadian Prime Minister, have some territory.
Header.
Canadian Prime Minister to Gentle. No, really, thanks anyway.
Header.
Gentle to Canadian Prime Minister. But I insist.
Header.
Bloc Québécois to Canadian Prime Minister. Accept toxically convex addition to our province, and we are out of here so fast your head will spin all the way around.
Header from that guy again.
Canadian Prime Minister to Gentle. Look, we're swimming in territory already. Have a look at an atlas, why don't you? We have way more territory than we know what to do with already. Plus, I don't mean to be rude either, but we're especially unkeen on accepting hopelessly befouled territory from you guys. Interdependence rhetoric or no, there's really just no way.
And again.
ABON 26 member EEC accuses U.S. of experialist domination.
Header.
Third world vegetables hurled in UN imbroglio.
10-point subheader.
Gentle to Prime Minister. Look, babe, take the territory, or you're going to be really, really sorry.
Header.
Sin City Shrink. Nation's velvetiest vocalist was hospitalized twice for mental illness.
Tabloid header.
Presidential history of emotional instability alleged by Las Vegas MD.
Respectable header.
My garden now's got tomatoes I couldn't lift even if I could hack through their vines with a machete to even reach them.
Tabloid header, Dateline Montpelier, Vermont, with photo that simply has got to have been doctored.
FEC called to investigate cusps.
Header.
Strategic misrepresentation of candidates' psych history has put nation, continent at risk, Dems charge.
12-point super subheader.
Top aides huddle as worries over Gentle's pathological inability to deal proactively with any sort of real or imagined rejection mount in face of Canadian showdown.
Meth-dependent headliner. Now at third daily in 17 months.
Both financial and diplomatic communities have reacted with increasing concern to reports that President Gentle has isolated himself in a small private suite at Bethesda Naval Hospital with several thousand dollars worth of sound and sterilization equipment, and is spending all day, every day, singing morose show tunes in inappropriate keys to the United States Marine Corps colonel who stands near
the Dermalatex Hypospectral Sterilization Appliance, handcuffed to the black box of United States nuclear codes. Unspecified services office spokespersons have declined to comment on reports of such erratic executive directives as ordering the Defense Department to commandeer department store giant Sears Co.'s entire inventory of Winnie the Pooh toddlerware under National Security Emergency Proviso 414. Requiring armed forces personnel to take target practice at cardboard silhouettes of what appear to be oxen, water buffalo, or Texas longhorn cattle. Preparing the release of a presidential address to the nation cartridge that purportedly consists entirely of the president seated at his desk with his head in his gloves intoning, "What's the point of going on?" over and over. Instructing silo personnel at all SAC installations north of 44 degrees to remove their missiles from the silos and then reinsert them upside down, and ordering the installation of massive air displacement effectuators 28 kilometers south of each such silo facing north. Anchors lead for kind of semi-cheesy weekly lurid news intensive summary cartridge. Unprecedented whopper revenues in third quarter, credited by Pillsbury BK to Gentle's creatively proactive resuscitation of post-network advertising. Adweek, 14-point full-color header. Gentle has completely lost mind, claims confidant OUS Chief Tyne at press conference. Threatens to detonate upside-down missiles in U.S. silos, irradiate Canada with aid of ATH-SCME Hellfans. Header. Willing to eliminate own map out of sheer pique if Canada nixes reconfiguration transfer of aesthetically unacceptable terrain. Pretty obviously homemade subheader. This catastatic feature of the puppet film's plot, that Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, threatens to bomb his own nation and toxify neighbors in an insane pout over Canada's reluctance to take re-demised title over ONAN's very own vast dump, resonates powerfully with those members of the movie's ETA audience, who know that this whole parodic pseudo-ONAN-Tyad scenario is actually a puppet-a-clef-type allusion to the dark legend of one Eric Clipperton and the Clipperton Brigade. In the very last couple years of solar, unsubsidized time, this kid, Eric Clipperton, appeared for the first time as an unseeded 16-year-old in East Coast regional tournament play. The little town or academy hailed from slot after Clipperton's name on tournament draw sheets just said IND, presumably for independent. Nobody'd heard of him before, or knew where he came from. He just sort of seepingly risen, some sort of human radon from someplace low and unknown, whence he lent the cliché win or die in the attempt, grotesquely literal new levels of sense. For the Clipperton legend derived from the fact that this Clipperton kid owned a hideously and immaculately maintained Glock 17 semi-automatic sidearm that came in a classy little leather-handled blonde wood case with German high Gothic script on it and a velvet gun-shaped concavity inside where the Glock 17 lay, nestled in plush velvet, gleaming, with another little rectangular divot for the 17-shot clip. And that he brought the gun case and Glock 17 out on the court with him along with his towels and water jug, and sticks and gear bag, and from his very first appearance on the East Coast Junior Tour, made clear his intention to blow his own brains out publicly, right there on court, if he should lose, ever, even once. Thus there came to be, in most every tournament, with the initial draw of 64, a group of three boys, then four, and by the semifinals five, then finally six boys, who for that tournament formed the Clipperton Brigade, players who'd had the misfortune to draw and meet Eric Clipperton and Clipperton's well-oiled Glock 17, and who, understandably, declined to be the player to cause Clipperton to eliminate his own map for keeps in public for something as comparatively cheesy as a tournament win over Clipperton. A win over Clipperton had no meaning because a loss to Clipperton had no meaning, and didn't hurt anybody's regional and USTA ranking, not once the guys in the USTA Computer Center caught on to the Clipperton strategic MO. Thus, An early exit from a tournament because of a loss to Clipperton came to be regarded as sort of like a walk in baseball, stats-wise. And a boy who found himself in the Clipperton Brigade and defaulted his round tended to view that tournament as a kind of unexpected vacation, a chance to rest and heal, to finally get some sun on the chest and ankles, to work on chinks in his game's armor, to reflect a little on what it all might mean. Clipperton's first meaningless victory ever came at 16, unseeded, at the Hartford Junior Open, first round, against one Ross Reet of Maddox, Ohio, and the just-opened Enfield Tennis Academy. For some reason, it's Strzok, who sort of specializes in this story and never misses a chance to tell new ETAs the tale of Clipperton versus Reet. Clipperton's an okay player, nothing spectacular, but also not like absurdly out of place at a regional grade tourney. But Reet is, at 15, seasoned and high-ranked, and the third seed at Hartford. And Reet is, for a while, as would be standard operating procedure for a high seed in the first round, basically clean under his nails with this unseeded unknown Eric Clipperton. At 1-4 in the second set, Clipperton sits down at the side change and, instead of toweling off, reaches into his gear bag and extracts his classy little blonde wood case and gets out the Glock 17. Fondles it. Takes out the clip and hefts it and rams it home in its slot at the base of the grip with a chillingly solid-sounding click. Caresses his left temple with the thing's blunt, shiny barrel. Everybody watching the match agrees. It is one ugly and all-business-looking piece of personal defense hardware. Clipperton climbs up the rungs of the lifeguardish chair the umpire, in his blue blazer, sits in.
158.
And uses the umpire's mic to make public his intention of blowing his personal brains out all over the court with a hideous Glock should he lose. The small first-round gallery stiffens and inhales and doesn't exhale for a long time. Reet, audibly, gulps. Reet is tall, densely freckled, a good kid, one of Incandenza's fair-haired boys. Not too bright, with the satellite tour so clearly in his future that at only 15 he's already starting cholera shots and mastering third-world exchange rates. And but for the remainder of the match, which lasts exactly 11 more games, Clipperton plays tennis with the Glock 17 held steadily to his left temple. The gun makes tossing kind of a hassle on Clipperton's serve, but Reet is letting the serves go by untouched anyway. None of the ETA staff has bothered to show up and coach Reet through what was supposed to be a standard first-round fingernail cleaning. And so Reet is strategically and emotionally all alone out there, and he's opted for not even pretending to make an effort, given what the unseeded Clipperton seems willing to sacrifice for a win. Ross Reet was the first and last junior player ever to shake Clipperton's free hand at the end of a match. And the moment's captured in a Hartford Current staff photo that some ETA wiseacre later glued to the door of Strzok's room with so much Elmer's all over the back that taking it off would gut the varnish. So the thing stays up for all in the hole to see. Reet, here up at the net on one knee, one arm over his eyes, the other hand extended upward to a Clipperton who'd simply obliterated him psychologically. And Ross Reet was never quite exactly the same ever again after that. Both Stitt and Delint have assured all future, potentially mercy-minded ETA males. And, the legend story goes, Eric Clipperton never henceforth loses. No one is willing to beat him and risk going through life with the sight of the Glock going off on his conscience. Nobody ever knows where Clipperton comes from to play. Never seen at airports or interstate exit ramps, or ever even spotted carb loading at any Denny's between matches. He just starts materializing, always alone, at increasingly high-level junior tournaments. Appears on draw sheets with IND by his name. Plays competitive tennis with a Glock at his left temple.
159.
And his opponents, unwilling to sacrifice Clipperton's hostage, Clipperton meme, barely even try, or else they go for impossible angles and spins, or else talk on mobile phones while they play, or try to hit every ball between their legs or behind their backs,
and the match's galleries tend to boo Clipperton just as much as they dare. And Clipperton sits and hefts his 17-shot clip and takes the brass-jacketed 9mm cartridges out sometimes and clicks a few together, ruminatively in his hand, in the sideline chair, at all the odd game breaks. And sometimes he tries little Western gunslinger trigger guard spins during the breaks. But when play resumes, Clipperton's deadly serious once more, and has the Glock 17 at his temple, playing, and mows through the lackadaisical Clipperton Brigade round by round, and wins the whole tournament by what is essentially psychic default. And then right after collecting his trophy, vanishes like the ground itself inhaled him. His only even remote friend on the junior tour is 8-year-old Mario Incandenza, whom Clipperton meets because, even though Disney Leith and an early pro-rector named Cantrell are shepherding the male tournament contingent, including a solid but sort of plateau-stuck and no longer much improving 17-year-old Oren Incandenza, that summer, ETA headmaster, Dr. J.O. Incandenza, shows up at quite a few of the events on the domestic circuit, doing under ostensible USTA auspices a two-part documentary on junior competitive tennis, stress, and light. And so Mario's tottering around with lens cases and toughy tripods, etc., and most of that late summer's meaningful events, and meets Clipperton, and finds Clipperton intriguing, and in ways he can't be very articulate about, hilarious. And is kind to him and seeks out his company, Clipperton's. Or at any rate, at least treats Clipperton like he exists, whereas by late July everybody else's attitude toward Clipperton resembled that kind of stiffly conspicuous non-recognition that, for example, accompanies farts at formal functions. One of himself's short test cartridges, shot to check out transverse aberration at various sun angles, the case's little adhesive sticker says, contains the only available footage of the late Eric Clipperton.
160.
From the preponderance of salt tablet dispensers and littered pledge husks and Dade County ambulances, it was pretty likely shot at the hideous, sun-kissed junior invitational cramp fest in August in Miami. Just a couple overexposed meters of Clipperton, head down and hunched on a low orange bleacher. Bony-shouldered and no shirt and untied Nikes, his gothic scripted case in his lap, his elbows on his knees and his hands spidered across both cheeks, staring down between his feet and trying not to smile, as a withered toddler-sized and forward-listing Mario stands beside him, supported by his portable police lock, holding a light meter and something else too halated to make out on the tape, open very wide for a homodontic laugh at something funny Clipperton has apparently just let slip. Hal, having smoked cannabis on four separate occasions, twice with others, on this continental day of rest, plus still in a kind of guiltily sickening stomach-pit shock from the afternoon's eschaton debacle, and his failure to intervene or even get up out of his patio chair, has lost a bit of his grip, and has just gotten on the outside of his fourth chocolate cannoli in half an hour, and is feeling the icy electric keening of some sort of incipient carry in the left molar range. And also now, as usual, after swinishness with sugar, finds himself sinking, emotionally, into a kind of distracted funk. The puppet film is reminiscent enough of the late himself that just about the only more depressing thing to pay attention to or think about would be advertising and the repercussions of ONANite reconfiguration for the U.S. advertising industry. Mario's film executes some rather over-arty flash cuts between the erections of Lucite fortifications and ATH-SCME and EWD displacement installations along the new U.S. border, on the one hand, and the shadowily implied Rodney Tyne disastrous love interest element with the voluptuous puppet representing the infamous and enigmatic Quebecois fatale known publicly only as Luria P. on the other. Tyne's puppet's tiny brown felt hand is on Luria's voluptuously padded little popsicle stick knee in the famous Vienna, Virginia, Szechuan Steakhouse, where, according to dark legend, subsidized time was conceived on the back of a chintzy Chinese zodiac paper placemat by R. Tyne. Hal happens to know the fall and rise of millennial U.S. advertising exceptionally well, because one of the only two academic things he's ever written about anything even remotely filmic
161.
Was a mammoth research paper on the tangled fates of broadcast television and the American ad industry. This was the final and grade-determining project in Mr. U. Ogilvie's year-long Intro to Entertainment Studies in May of YPW. And Hal, the seventh grader, and only up to R in the condensed OED, wrote about TV advertising's demise with a reverent tone that sounded like the events had taken place at the misty remove of glaciers and guys in pelts, instead of just 4 years prior, more or less, overlapping with the waxing of the gentle era and experialist reconfiguration Mario's Puppet Show makes fun of. There's no question that the network television industry, meaning, since PBS is a whole different kettle, the Big Three, plus the fast-starting but low-endurance Fox, had already been in serious trouble. Between the exponential proliferation of cable channels, the rise of the total viewer control, handheld remotes known historically as zappers, and VCR recording advances that used subtle volume and hysterical pitch sensors to edit most commercials out of any program taped, here a rather chatty digression on legal battles between networks and VCR manufacturers over the edit function that Mr. O drew a big red yawning skull next to, in the margin, out of impatience. The networks were having problems drawing the kind of audiences they needed to justify the ad rates their huge overheads slavering maw demanded. The Big Four's arch foe was America's 100-plus regional and national cable networks, which, in the premillennial Limbaugh era of extraordinarily generous Justice Department interpretation of the Sherman statutes, had coalesced into a fractious but potent trade association under the stewardship of TCI's Malone, TBS's Turner, and a shadowy Albertan figure who owned the view out the simulated window of various lavish homes and exotic locales channel, the Yuletide Fireplace channel, CBC Cable's educational programming matrix, and four of Le Groupe Videotron's five big Canadian shop-at-home networks. Mounting an aggressive Hearts and Minds campaign that derided the passivity of hundreds of millions of viewers, forced to choose nightly between only four statistically pussified network broadcasters, then extolled the empoweringly American choice of 500-plus esoteric cable options, the American Council of Disseminators of Cable was attacking the four right at the ideological root, the psychic matrix, where viewers had been conditioned rather deliciously, by the Big Four networks and their advertisers themselves, Hal notes, to associate the freedom to choose and the right to be entertained with all that was U.S. and true. The AC/DC campaign, brilliantly orchestrated by Boston, Massachusetts, Viney and Veals Advertising, was pummeling the Big Four in the fiscal thorax with its ubiquitous anti-passivity slogan, "Don't sit still for anything less," when a wholly unintended coup de grace to network viability was delivered in the form of an unrelated Viney and Veals side venture. V&V, like most U.S. ad agencies, greedily buttered its bread on every conceivable side when it could, and started taking advantage of the plummeting Big Four advertising rates to launch effective network ad campaigns for products and services that wouldn't previously have been able to afford national image proliferation. For the obscure local Nunhagen Aspirin Company of Framingham, Massachusetts, Viney and Veals got the Enfield-based National Craniofacial Pain Foundation to sponsor a huge touring exhibition of paintings by artists with crippling craniofacial pain about crippling craniofacial pain. The resultant network Nunhagen ads were simply silent 30-second shots of some of the exhibits, with Nunhagen aspirin in soothing pale pastels at lower left. The paintings themselves were excruciating, the more so because consumer HDTV had arrived, at least in the very upscale in Candenza home. The ads with the more dental pain-type paintings, Hal doesn't even want to think back on. While with a fragment of cannoli wedged someplace upper left, he keeps looking around for Shocked to ask him to have a angle-mirrored look at. One he can recall was of an ordinary middle-class American guy's regular face, but with a tornado coming out of the right eye socket and a mouth at the vortex of that tornado screaming.
and that was a mild one.
162.
The ads cost next to nothing to produce. Nonegan aspirin sales went nationally roofward, even as ratings figures for the Nonegan ads themselves went from low to abysmal. People found the painting so excruciating that they were buying the product but recoiling from the ads. Now, you'd think this wouldn't matter so long as the product itself was selling so well. This fact that millions of national viewers were zapping or surfing to a different channel with their remotes the moment a silent, painted, twisted face with a hatchet in its forehead came on. But what made the Nonegan ads sort of fatally powerful was that they also compromised the ratings figures for the ads that followed them, and for the programs that enclosed the ads, and worse, were disastrous because they were so violently unpleasing to look at that they awakened from their spectatorial slumbers, literally, millions of network devotees who'd hitherto been so numbed and pacified, they usually hadn't bothered to expend the thumb-muscle energy required to zap or surf away from anything on the screen, awakened legions of these suddenly violently repelled and disturbed viewers to the power and agency their thumbs actually afforded them. Viney and Veels' next broadcast, Cash Cow, a lurid series of spots for a national string of walk-in liposuction clinics, reinforced the V&V trend of high product sales but dreadful ad ratings. And here the Big Four were really put on the spot, because, even though the critics and PTAs and eating disorder-oriented distaff packs were denouncing the lipovax spots, shots of rippling cellulite and explicit clips of procedures that resemble crosses between hyperbolic Hoover upright demonstrations, and filmed autopsies, and cholesterol-conscious cooking shows that involved a great deal of chicken fat drainage. And even though audiences' flights from the lipovax spots themselves were absolutely gutting ratings for the other ads and the shows around them, network execs' sweaty sleep infected with vivid REM visions of flaccid, atrophied thumbs coming twitchily to life over remote zap and surf controls. Even though the spots were again fatally potent, the Lipovax string's revenues were so obscenely enhanced by the ads that Lipovac Unlimited could soon afford to pay obscene sums for 30-second network spots, truly obscene sums the besieged four now needed in the very worst way. And so the Lipovac ads ran and ran, and much currency changed hands, and overall network ratings began to slump as if punctured with something blunt. From a historical perspective, it's easy to accuse the network corporations of being greedy and short-sighted with regard to explicit liposuction. But Hal argued, with the compassion Mr. Ogilvy found surprising in a seventh grader, that it's probably hard to be restrained and far-sighted when you're fighting against a malignant, invasive, V&V-backed cable cabal for your very fiscal life day to day. In hindsight, though, the Big Four's spinal camel straw had to have been V&V's trio of deep-focus black-and-white spots for a tiny Wisconsin cooperative firm that sold tongue scrapers by prepaid mail. These ads just clearly crossed some kind of psycho-aesthetic line, regardless of the fact that they single-handedly created a national tongue-scraper industry and put Fond du Lac's No Coat Inc. on the Fortune 500.
163.
Stylistically reminiscent of those murderous mouthwash, deodorant, and dandruff shampoo scenarios that had an anti-hero's chance encounter with a gorgeous desire object ending in repulsion and shame because of an easily correctable hygiene deficiency, the no-coat spot's chilling emotional force could be located in the exaggerated hideousness of the near geologic layer of gray-white material coating the tongue of the otherwise handsome pedestrian who accepts a gorgeous meter maid's coquettish invitation to have a bit of a lick of the ice cream cone she's just bought from an avuncular sidewalk vendor. The lingering close-up on an extended tongue that must be seen to be believed, coat-wise. The slow-motion full-frontal shot of the maid's face going slack with disgust as she recoils. The returned cone falling unfelt from her repulsion-paralyzed fingers. The nightmarish slow-mo with which the mortified pedestrian reels away into street traffic with his whole arm over his mouth. The avuncular vendor's kindly face now hateful and writhing as he hurls hygienic invectives. These ads shook viewers to the existential core, apparently. It was partly a matter of plain old taste. Ad critics argued that the no-coat spots were equivalent to, like, Preparation H filming a procto exam, or a depend adult undergarment camera panning for floor puddles at a church social. But Hal's paper located the level at which the Big Four's audiences reacted, here, as way closer to the soul than mere tastelessness can get. V&V's no-coat campaign was a case study in the eschatology of emotional appeals. It's Howard, a kind of Uber ad casting a shaggy shadow back across a whole century of broadcast persuasion. It did what all ads were supposed to do. Create an anxiety relievable by purchase. It just did it way more well than wisely, given the vulnerable psyche of an increasingly hygiene-conscious USA in those times. The no-coat campaign had three major consequences. The first was that horrible year Hal vaguely recalls when a nation became obsessed with the state of its tongue, when people would no sooner leave home without a tongue scraper and an emergency backup tongue scraper than they'd fail to wash and brush and spray. The year when the sink and mirror areas of public restrooms were such grim places to be. The no-coat co-op folks traded in their bagosh overalls and hand-woven ponchos for Armani and Dior, then quickly disintegrated into various eight-figure litigations. But by this time, everybody from Procter & Gamble to Tom's of Maine had its own brand's scraper out, some of them with baroque and potentially hazardous electronic extras. The second consequence was that the Big Four broadcast networks finally just plain fell off the shelf, fiscally speaking, riding a crest of public disaffection not seen since the days GIF commercials had strangers shoving their shiny noses in your open jar. The Malone, Turner, and shadowy Albertan-led cable cabal got sponsors whose ads had been running as distant as 7 or 8 spots on either side of the no-coat gaggers to jump ship to AC/DC. U.S. Broadcast TV's True Angels of Death, Malone and Turner then immediately parlayed this fresh injection of sponsorial capital into unrefusable bids for the rights to the NCAA Final Four, the MLB World Series, Wimbledon, and the Pro Bowlers Tour, at which point the Big Four suffered further defections from Schick and Gillette on one side, and Miller and Budd on the other. Fox filed for Chapter 11 protection Monday after AC/DC's coup announcements, and the Dow turned grisly indeed on GE, Paramount, Disney, etc. Within days, 3 out of the Big Four networks had ceased broadcasting operations, and ABC had to fall back on old Happy Days marathons of such relentless duration that bomb threats began to be received both by the network and by poor old Henry Winkler, now hairless and sugar-addicted in La Honda, California, and seriously considering giving that lurid-looking but hope-provoking Lipovac procedure a try. But the ironic third consequence was that almost all the large, slick advertising agencies with substantial network billings, among these the Icarian, Viney, and Veals, went down too in the Big Four's maelstrom, taking with them countless production companies, graphic artists, account execs, computer enhancement technicians, ruddy-tongued product spokespersons, horn-rimmed demographers, etc. The millions of citizens in areas for one reason or another not cable available ran their VCRs into meltdown, got homicidally tired of Happy Days, and then began to find themselves with vast, maddening blocks of utterly choiceless and unentertaining time. And domestic crime rates, as well as out-and-out suicides, topped out at figures that cast a serious pall over the penultimate year of the millennium. But these consequences own consequence, with all the Yankee ingenious irony that attends true resurrections, comes when the now combined Big Four, muted and unseen, now, but with its remaining creditor-proof assets now supporting only those rapaciously clever executive minds that can survive the cuts down to a skeleton of a skeleton staff, rises from the dust heap and has a collective last hurrah, ironically, deploying V&V's old pro-choice slash anti-passivity appeal to obliterate the ACDC that had just months before obliterated the Big Four, bringing TCI's Malone down on a golden bell-shaped chute and sending TBS's Turner into self-imposed nautical exile. Because, enter one Noreen Lace Forshay, the USC-educated, video-rental mogulette, who in the BS-90s had taken Phoenix's intermission video chain from the middle of the Sunbelt Pack to a national distribution second only to Blockbuster Entertainment in gross receipts. The woman called by Microsoft's Gates the killer app queen, and by Blockbuster's Bazenga, the only woman I personally fear. Convincing the rapacious skeletal remains of the Big Four to consolidate its combined production, distribution, and capital resources behind a front company she'd had incorporated and idling ever since she'd first foreseen broadcast apocalypse in the Nunhagen ads' psycho-fiscal fallout. The front, an obscure-sounding concern called Interlace Tel Entertainment. Lace Forshay then went and persuaded ad maestro P. Tom Veals, at that time mourning his remorse-tortured partner's half-gainer off the Tobin Bridge by drinking himself toward pancreatitis in a Beacon Hill brownstone, to regather himself and orchestrate a profound national dissatisfaction with the passivity involved even in DSS-based cable watching. What matter whether your choices are 4, or 104, or 504, Beale's campaign argued. Because here you were, assuming, of course, you were even cable-ready or dish-equipped and able to afford monthly fees that applied no matter what you chose each month, here you were, sitting here, accepting only what was pumped by distant AC/DC fiat into your entertainment ken. Here you were, consoling yourself about your dependence and passivity with rapid-fire zapping and surfing that were starting to be suspected to cause certain rather nasty types of epilepsy over the longish term. The cable cabal's promise of empowerment, the campaign argued, was still just the invitation to choose which of 504 visual spoon feedings you'd sit there and open wide for.
164.
And so, but what if, their campaign's appeal basically ran, what if, instead of sitting still for choosing the least of 504 infantile evils, the Vox and Digitus Populi could choose to make its home entertainment literally and essentially adult? That is, what if, according to Interlace, what if a viewer could, more or less, 100% choose what's on at any given time? Choose and rent, over PC and modem and fiber optic line, from tens of thousands of second-run films, documentaries, the occasional sport, old beloved non-Happy Days programs, wholly new programs, cultural stuff, and the rest, all prepared by the time-tested, newly lean Big Four's mammoth vaults and production facilities, and packaged and disseminated by Interlace Tel Ent, in convenient fiber-optic pulses that fit directly on the new palm-size 4.8 megabyte PC diskettes Interlace was marketing as cartridges. Viewable right there on your trusty PC's high-resolution monitor. Or, if you preferred and so chose, jackable into a good old pre-millennial widescreen TV with at most a coaxial or two. Self-selected programming, chargeable on any major card or on a special low finance charge Interlace account, available to any of the 76% of U.S. households possessed of PC, phone line, and verifiable credit. What if, Veals' spokeswoman ruminated aloud, what if the viewer could become his slash her own programming director? What if she, he could define the very entertainment happiness it was her slash his right to pursue? The rest, for Hal, is recent history. By the time not only second-run Hollywood releases, but a good many first-run films, plus new sitcoms and crime dramas and near-live sports, Plus now also, big-name anchor nightly newscasts, weather, art, health, and financial analysis cartridges were available and pulsing nicely onto cartridges everywhere. The ranks of AC/DC's own solvent program pumpers have been winnowed back to the old movie and afternoon baseball major metro regional systems of more like the BS-80s. Passive pickings were slim now. American mass entertainment became inherently proactive, consumer-driven. And because advertisements were now out of the televisual question, any halfway sensitive power PC's CPU could edit out anything shrill or ungratifying in the post-receipt review function of an entertainment diskette, cartridge production, meaning by now both the satellitic spontaneous dissemination of viewer-selected menu programming and the factory recording of programming on packaged 9.6-megabyte diskettes, available cheap and playable on any CD-ROM-equipped system. Yes, cartridge production, though tentacularly controlled by an interlace that had patented the digital transmission process for moving images and held more stock than any one of the five baby bells involved in the Internet Fiber Optic Transmission Grid, bought for 17 cents on the dollar from GTE, after Sprint went belly up trying to launch a primitive, naked, early, mask and tableau-less form of ideophony, became almost Hobbesianly free market. No more network reluctance to make a program too entertaining for fear its commercials would pale in comparison. The more pleasing a given cartridge was, the more orders there were for it from viewers. And the more orders for a given cartridge, the more interlace kicked back to whatever production facility they'd acquired it from. Simple. Personal pleasure and gross revenue looked at last to lie along the same demand curve, at least as far as home entertainment went. And as Interlace's eventual outright purchase of the network's production talent and facilities, of two major home computer conglomerates, of the cutting-edge Frox 2100 CD-ROM licenses, of Apps, Inc., of RCA's DSS orbiters and hardware patents, and of the digital-compatible patents, to the still-needing-to-come-down-and-price-a-little technology of HDTV's visually-enhanced color monitor with microprocessed circuitry and 2-to-the-10th area more lines of optical resolution. As these acquisitions allowed Noreen Lace-Forche's cartridge dissemination network to achieve vertical integration and economies of scale, viewers, pulse reception, and cartridge fees went down markedly.
165.
And then, the further increased revenues from consequent increases in order and rental volume were plowed presciently back into more fiber optic intergrid cable laying, into outright purchase of three of the five baby bells Internet had started with, into extremely attractive rebate offers on special new interlace-designed RISC-grade high-def screen PCs with mimetic resolution cartridge view motherboards.
166.
Recognizably renamed by Veals' boys in recognition, teleputers, or TPs, into fiber-only modems, and of course, into extremely high-quality entertainments that viewers would freely desire to choose even more.
167.
But there were, could be, no ads of any kind in the interlace pulses or ROM cartridges, was the point Hal's presentation kept struggling to return to. And so then, besides, for example, a Turner who kept litigating bitterly via shortwave radio from his equatorial yacht, the true loser in the shift from cable to interlace grid was an American advertising industry already reeling from the death of broadcast's Big Four. No significant market seemed in any hurry to open up and compensate for the capping of TV's old gusher. Agencies, reduced to skeletal cells of their best and most rapacious creative minds, cast wildly about for new pulses to finger and niches to fill. Billboards sprouted with near mycological fury alongside even rural two-laners. No bus, train, trolley, or hack went unfestooned with high-gloss ads. Commercial airliners began for a while to trail those terse, translucent ad banners, usually reserved for, like, Piper Cubs over football games and July beaches. magazines, already endangered by HD video equivalents, got so full of those infuriating little Fallout card ads that fourth-class postal rates ballooned, making the email of their video equivalents that much more attractive, in another vicious cycle. Chicago's once-vaunted Sickingen, Smith, and Lundine went so far as to get Ford to start painting little domestic product come-ons on their new line's side panels, an idea that fizzled as U.S. customers in Nike T-shirts and Marlboro caps perversely refused to invest in cars that sold out. In contrast to just about the whole rest of the industry, a certain, partnerless Metro Boston ad agency was doing so well that it was more out of ennui and a sense of unlikely challenge that Tom Veals consented to manage PR for the fringe candidacy of a former crooner and schmaltz mogul who went around swinging a mic and ranting about literally clean streets and creatively refocused blame and rocketing people's waste into the forgiving chill of infinite space.
168.
The 30th of April to the 1st of May, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Marat did not quite sleep. They had remained on the shelf for some hours. He thought it a bit of much that Steeply refused even for a brief time to sit down upon the ground. If his persona's skirt rode up above his weapon, what was the difference? Were grotesque and humiliating undergarments also involved? Marat's wife had been in an irreversible coma for 14 months. Marat was able to refresh himself without quite sleeping. It was not a state of fugue or neural relaxation, but a type of detachment. He had learned this in the months after losing his legs to a USA train. Part of Marat floated off and hovered somewhere just above him, crossing its legs, nibbling at his consciousness as does a spectator at popcorn. At some times on the outcropping, Steeply went farther than crossing his arms, almost embracing himself, chilled, but unwilling to comment on the chill. Marat noted that the gesture of self-embrace appeared convincingly feminine and unconscious. Steeply's preparations for his returning field assignment had been disciplined and effective. The feature of complete unswallowability about Monsieur Steeply, as a USA female journalist, even a massive and unfortunate-looking USA female journalist, was his feet. These were broad and yellow-nailed, hairy and trollesque, the ugliest feet Marat had observed anywhere south of 60 degrees north, and the ugliest, supposedly, female feet of his experience. Both men were strangely reluctant somehow to broach the subject of plans for getting down off the shelf in the utter dark. Steeply didn't even waste time wondering how Marat could have gotten up or down there in the first place, short of some sort of helicopter drop, which capricious winds and the proximity of the mountainside made unlikely. The dogma around unspecified services was that if Les Assassins de Fauteuil Roulant had one Achilles heel, it was their penchant for showing off, making a spectacle of denying any kind of physical limitation, etc. Steeply had field interfaced with Rémy Marat once on a rickety-feeling Louisiana oil platform 50-plus clicks out of Kalu Bay, covered the whole time by armed Cajun sympathizers. Marat always disguised the boggling size of his arms under a long-sleeved windbreaker. His eyes were half-closed whenever Steeply turned to look. If he, Marat, were a cat, he would be purring. One hand stayed below the blanket at all times, Steeply noted. Steeply himself had a small and unregistered Taurus PT-9 taped to his shaved inner thigh, which was the main reason he was reluctant to sit down on the outcropping stone. The weapon was unsafetied. In the faint loom and starlight, Marat found the four-limbed American's high-heeled feet compellingly grotesque, like loaves of soft, processed USA bread being slowly squeezed and mangled by the footwear's straps. The meaty compression of the toes at the shoe's open tips, the leather faintly creaking as he bobbed up and down, hugging himself chillily in the sleeveless summer dress, his fleshy bare arms webbed redly with mottle in the chill, one arm luridly scratched. The received wisdom among Quebecois anti-ONAN cells was that there was something latent and sadistic in the Bureau des Services Sans Spécificité's assignments of fictional personae for its field operatives, casting men as women, women as longshoremen or orthodox rabbinicals, heterosexual men as homosexual men, Caucasians as Negroes or caricaturesque Haitians and Dominicans, healthy males as degenerative nerve disease sufferers, healthy women operatives as hydrocephalic boys or epileptic public relations executives, non-deformed USOUS personnel made not only to pretend but sometimes to actually suffer actual deformity, all for the realism of their field personae. Steeply, silent, rose and fell absently on the toes of these feet. The feet were also visibly unused to high USA women's heels, for they were mangled-looking, deprived of flowing blood, and abundantly blistered, and the smallest toes' nails were blackening and preparing, Marat noted, in the future, to fall off. But Marat knew also that something within the real Monsieur Hugh Steeply did need the humiliations of his absurd field personae. But the more grotesque or unconvincing he seemed likely to be as a disguised persona, the more nourished and actualized his deep parts felt in the course of preparation for the humiliating attempt to portray. He, Steeply, used the mortification he felt as a huge woman, or pale Negro, or palsied twit of a degenerative musician, as fuel for the assignment's performance. Steeply welcomed the subsumption of his dignity and self in the very role that offended his dignity of self. The psychomechanics became too confusing for Marat, who had not the capacity for abstractions of his AFR superiors, Fortier and Bruyim. But he knew this was why Steeply was one of Service Sans Spécificité's finest field operatives, once spending the better part of a year in magenta robes, sleeping 3 hours nightly, and allowing his large head to be shaved and teeth removed, shaking a tambourine in airports and selling plastic flowers on median strips, to infiltrate a cult-fronted 3-amino-8 hydroxytetralene import ring in the USA city Seattle.
169.
Steeply said, "Because this is the thing about the AFR that really gives them the fantods, if you're talking about fear and want to fear."
He spoke either quietly or not, that Marat could determine. The empty expanse they both faced, off the shelf, sucked all resonance, causing every sound to sound self-enclosed, and every utterance to seem flatly soft and somehow over-intimate, almost post-coital. The sounds of things said beneath blankets, winter beating at the log walls. Steeply himself appeared frightened, perhaps, or confused. He continued,
"This disinterest by you guys, it seems, in anything but the harm itself. Just getting the entertainment out there to hurt us."
"The naked aggression by us?" Muscles beneath the nylons of the calves bulged and receded as Steeply bobbed.
"The boys in behavioral science say they can't see any sort of positive political goal the AFR even wants. Anything Duplessis was having your Fortier work toward."
"The Jours des Fantades are meaning fear, confusion, standing hair.
The FLQ and the Montcalmists, shit. Even the most whacked out of Albertans ultra-rightists."
Monsieur Duplessis had once studied beneath radical Edmonton Jesuits, Marat reflected.
"Them we can begin to understand as political bodies. Them we can more or less get a feel for dealing with.
Their aggression is clothed in agenda. The Bureau of You proceeds."
Steeply's was a thinking face now, in apparent puzzlement.
"They at least have aims, real desires."
"For themselves?"
Steeply appeared convincingly to ruminate.
"It's like there's a context for the whole game, then, with them. We know where we stand differs from where they stand. There's a sort of playing field of context."
Causing the chair to squeak, Marat again rotated two fingers of a hand in the air, which for Quebecers signifies impatience.
"Rules of play. Rules of engagement."
The other hand was with the Sterling UL machine pistol beneath the blanket.
"Even historically, the 60s bomb tossers, the Spic separatists, the ragheads."
"Very charming. These are attractive terms."
"Ragheads, Colombians, Brazilians.
They had positive objectives.
Desires for self which you could understand.
Even if the objectives were nothing more than things we could file, pinned to the board under stated objectives. The pathetic Spics, they wanted certain things. There was a context, a compass for maneuvers against them.
Your guardians of national security could understand these positive desires of self-interest. Look at them and relate, as one says at least, knowing where you stand on the field of play.
Steeply slowly nodded, as if to only himself. There wasn't just pure malice. There was never the sense that here were some people who had just all of a sudden let the air out of your tires for no reason.
You allege we disperse our resources deflecting automobile tires?
A figure of speech. Or, for example, a serial killer, a sadist, somebody who wants you down just for the deviant sake of wanting you down. A deviant.
Far south, a blinking system of tricolored lights described a spiral over the airport's tower's pulsing tip. This was a landing aircraft. Steeply lit another cigarette off the butt of his previous and then tossed the butt, peering over the shelf's edge to watch its spiraled fall. Marat was looking up and right.
Steeply said, "Because politics are one thing. Even way out far in the distance fringe politics are one thing. Your 40A doesn't seem to care much about reconfiguration, territory, redemisement, cartography, tariffs, Finlandization, ONA-anite Anschluss, or toxic waste displacement."
"Experialism,"
Steeply said, "or so-called experialism. Even separatism. None of the other cells' agendas seem to drive you people. Most of the office sees it as just sheer malice with you. No agenda or story.
And for you, there is something appalling."
Steeply pursed his lips, as if trying to blow something off them.
"But when there are delineatable strategic political goals and objectives, when there's some set of ends we can make sense of the malice with, then it's just business."
"Nothing of persons."
Marat was looking up. Some of the stars seemed to flutter, others to burn with more steadiness.
"We know which end is up when it's business. We've got a field and a compass."
He regarded Marat directly in a way that was not accusing.
"This seems personal," he said.
Marat could not think of descriptions for the way Steeply regarded him. Neither was it sad, nor inquisitive, nor quite ruminative. There were small flickers and shadows of movements around the flickers of the celebratory fire down far away on the floor of the desert. Marat could not determine whether Steeply was truly revealing emotions about himself. The flickers continually went out. Small shreds of young laughter drifted up to them in the vacuous silence. There were also sometimes rustles in the hillside's scrub of gravel or small living nightly things. Or whether perhaps Steeply was trying to give him something, let him know something, and determine whether it went back to Monsieur Fortier. Marat's arrangement with the Office of Unspecified Services seemed most often to consist in submitting himself to numerous tests and games of truth and betrayal. He felt often with USOUS like a caged rodent, being regarded blandly by bland men in white coats. Marat shrugged.
"USA has previously been hated. Richly so. Channing Path and your Maxwell-ass company. The trans-Latin cocaine cartels. And the poor late Monsieur Kemp with his exploding home. Did not both Iraq and Iran call USA the very large Satan? As you hatefully say, they have heads of rags?"
Steeply exhumed smoke quickly to reply.
"Yes, but there were still contexts and ends. Revenue, religion, spheres of influence, Israel, petroleum, neo-Marxism, post-Cold War power jockeying. There was always a third thing.
Some desire.
Some piece of business. Some third thing between them and us. It wasn't just us. It was something they wanted from us, or wanted us out of."
Steeply seemed earnestly to say it.
"The third thing, the goal or desire, it mediated the ill will, abstracted it somehow."
"For this is how one who is sane proceeds," Marat said,
paying great concentration to aligning the blanket's hems against his chest and wheels.
some desire of self, and efforts expending to meet that desire.
Not just wanting negatives, Stinkley said, shaking the lurid head. Not just wanting some other's harm for no purpose.
Marat again found himself pretending to sniff with the congestion.
And their USA purpose? Desires?
This he asked quietly. Its sound was strange against stone.
Steeply was pinching yet a next particle of tobacco from his lipstick. He said, "This you can't generalize on with most of us, since our whole system is founded on your individual's freedom to pursue his own individual desires."
His mascara had now cooled in the formations of its past running. Marat kept silent and fussed with the blanket as Steeply sometimes regarded him. A whole minute passed this way.
Finally, Steeply said, For me personally, as an American, Ramey, if you're really serious, I think it's probably your standard old basic American dreams and ideals. Freedom from tyranny, from excessive want, fear, censorship of speech and thought.
He was looking with seriousness, even in this wig.
The old ones, tested by time, relative plenty, meaningful work, adequate leisure time. The ones you might call corny.
His smiling revealed to Marat lipstick upon one incisor.
We want choice. A sense of efficaciousness in choice. To be loved by someone. To freely love who you happen to love. To be loved irregardless of whether you can tell them classified stuff about your job. To have them just trust you and trust that you know what you're doing. To feel valued. Not to be agendalessly despised. To have good neighborly relations. Cheap and abundant energy. Pride in your work and family and home.
The lipstick had been smeared onto the tooth when the finger had removed the grain of tobacco. He was faisait monter la pression.
170.
The little things. Access to transport, good digestion, work-saving appliances, a wife who doesn't mistake your job's requirements for your own fetishes, reliable waste removal and disposal, sunsets over the Pacific, shoes that don't cut off circulation, frozen yogurt, a tall lemonade on a squeak-free porch swing.
Marat's face, it showed nothing.
The loyalty of a domestic pet.
Steeply pointed the cigarette.
There you go, friend.
High quality entertainment. A value for the dollar of leisure and spectation.
Steeply laughed agreeably, exhaling a shaped sausage of smoke. In response to this, Marat smiled. There was some silence for thinking until Marat finally said, looking up and off to think,
"This Eurasian type of person and desires appears to me like almost the classic, utilitaire?
A French appliance?
Comment dit," Marat said, "utilitarian, maximum pleasure, minimize displeasure. Result? What is good? This is the USA of you."
Steeply pronounced the USA English word for Marat then. Then a sustained pause. Steeply rose and fell upon his toes. A bonfire of young persons was burning some kilometers down away on the desert floor, the flames burning in a seeming ring instead of a sphere.
Marat said, "But yes, but precisely whose pleasure and whose pain? In this personality type's equation of what is good."
When Steeply removed a particle of the cigarette from the lip, he would then roll it absently between his first finger and thumb. This did not appear womanly.
Come again?
Marat scratched inside the windbreaker.
I am wondering, me, on the equations of this USA type. The best good is each individual USA person's maximum pleasure? Or it is the maximum pleasure for all the people?
Steeply nodded in a way that indicated willing patience for someone whose wits were not too speedy.
But there you go. But this question itself shows how our different types of national character part ways from each other, Ramey. The American genius, our good fortune, is that someplace along the line back there in American history, them realizing that each American seeking to pursue his maximum good results together in maximizing everyone's good.
Ah.
We learned this as early as grade school, as kids.
I am seeing.
This is what lets us steer free of oppression and tyranny. Even your Greekly democratic, howling mob-type tyranny. The United States, a community of sacred individuals, which reveres the sacredness of the individual choice. The individual's right to pursue his own vision of the best ratio of pleasure to pain. Utterly sacrosanct. Defended with teeth and bared claws all through our history.
Bien sûr.
Steeply for the first time seemed to be feeling with his hand his wig's disorder. He was attempting to straightly reposition it without removing the wig. Marat tried not to envision what his BSS had done to the natural brown male hair of Steeply to accommodate the complex wig. Steeply said, "It might be hard for you to quite understand what's so precious about this for us, from across this chasm of different values that separates our peoples." Marat flexed his hand.
"Perhaps because it is so general and abstracted. In practice, however, you may force me to understand."
"We don't force. It's exactly about not forcing our history's genius. You are entitled to your values of maximum pleasure, so long as you don't fuck with mine. Are you seeing?"
"Perhaps help me see by practical evidence. An instance. Suppose you are able at one moment to increase your own pleasure, but the cost of this is the displeasuring pain of another. Another sacred individual's displeasing pain."
Steeply said, "Well, now this is precisely what gives us the fantods about the AFR. Why it's so important, I think, to remember how we come from different cultures and value systems, Raimi. Because in our U.S. value system, anybody who derives an increase in pleasure from somebody else's pain is a deviant, a sadistic sicko, and is thereby excluded from the community of everybody's right to pursue their own best pleasure-to-pain ratio. Sickos deserve compassion and the best treatment feasible, but they're not part of the big picture."
Marat willed himself not to rise on his stumps again.
No, but not another's pain as a pleasurable end in itself. I did not mean where my pleasure is your pain. Imagine there arises a situation in which your deprivation or pain is merely as a consequence, the price of my own pleasure.
You mean you're talking a tough choices, limited resources type situation?
But in the simplest of examples, the most childlike case.
Marat's eyes momentarily gleamed with enthusiasm.
Suppose that you and I, we both wish to enjoy a hot bowl of the habitant soupepois.
Steeply said, "You mean..."
"But yes, French-Canadian type pea soup. Produit du Montréal. Savour maison. Prêt à servir."
171.
"What is it with you people and this stuff?"
"In this case, imagining both you and I are in the worst way craving for habitant soup. But there is one can only, of the small and well-known single-serving size."
"An American invention, by the way, the 3S, let's insert."
The part of Marat's mind that hovered above and watched coldly, it could not know whether Steeply was being deliberately, parodically dense and annoying to arouse Marat to some revealing passion. Marat made his rotary gesture of impatience slowly.
"But, okay," he said neutrally. "It is simple here. We both want the soup. Sell me my pleasure from eating the habitant soupepois as the price of your pain at not eating soup when you badly crave it."
Marat was patting his pockets for something.
"And the reverse, if you are who eats the serving. But the use of genius for each persuivre Lebonair, then, who can decide who may receive this soup?"
172.
Steeply stood with weight on one leg.
"Example's a bit oversimplified. We bid on the soup, maybe. We negotiate. Maybe we divide the soup."
"No, for the ingenious single-serving size of serving is notoriously for only one. And we are both large and vigorous USA individuals who have spent the afternoon watching huge men in pads and helmets hurl themselves at one another in the high definition of interlace. And we are both ravenous for the cessation of a complete hot bowl's serving. Half the bowl would only torment this craving I have."
The fast shadow of pain across the face of Steeply showed Marat's choice of example was witty. The divorced USA man has much experience with the small size of single-serving products. Marat said,
Okay, yes, why should I, as the sacred individual, give you half of my soup? My own pleasure over torment is what is good, for I am a loyal USA, a genius of this individual desire.
The bonfire slowly was filling out. Another cross of colored light circled the airport area of Tucson. Steeply's movements of smoothing the wig and twisting fingers through the snarls of hair became perhaps more abrupt and frustrated. Steeply said,
Well, whose soup is it legally? Who actually bought the soup?
Marat shrugged.
Not relevant for my question. Suppose a third party, now unfortunately deceased. He appears at our flat with a can of soup au pois to eat while watching recorded USA Sporting, and suddenly is scratching his heart and falls to the carpeting deceased, holding the soup we are now both so wishing.
Then we bid on the soup. Whoever's got the most desire for the soup, and is willing to fork over the higher price, buys out the other's half. Then the other just rolls on down to Safeway, and buys himself some more soup. Whoever's willing to put his money where his hunger is gets the dead guy's soup.
Marat shook his head without any heat.
The Safeway store and bidding. These are also not relevant to my question, I hope, the example of pea soup to raise. Which perhaps this is a dull-witted question.
Steeply was at the wig with both hands for repair. Former perspiration had mashed its form inward on one side, as well as small clots and small burrs from the falls of his descent to the outcropping. Presumably there was no comb or brushes in his small evening's wear purse. The rear of his dress was dirty. The straps of his prosthesis brassiere dug cruelly into the meat of his back and shoulders. Again there was for Marat the picture of something soft being slowly throttled. Steeply was responding,
No, I know what you want to raise, all right. You want to talk politics. Scarcity, and allocating, and tough choices, all right? Politics we can understand, all right. Politics we can discuss. I bet I know where you're... You want to raise the question of what prevents 310 million individual American happiness pursuers from all going around bonking each other over the head and taking each other's soup. A state of nature, my own pleasure, and to hell with all the rest.
Marat had his handkerchief out.
What does this wish to mean, this bonking?
Because this simplistic example shows just how far apart across the chasm our people's values are, friend. Steeply was saying this. Because a certain basic amount of respect for the wishes of other people is required, is in my interest, in order to preserve a community where my own wishes and interests are respected, okay? My total and overall happiness is maximized by respecting your individual sanctity and not simply kicking you in the knee and running off with the soup. Steeply watched Marat blow one nostril into the handkerchief. Marat was one of the rare types who did not examine the hanky after he blew. Steeply said,
But then I can anticipate somebody on your side of the chasm retorting with something like, quote, Yes, my very good ami, but what if your rather for the pleasurable soup is some individual outside your community, for example, you'll say, Let's just make the example that it's a hapless Canadien, foreign, en outre.
Separated from me by a chasm of history and language and value and deep respect for individual freedom. Then in this wholly random instance, there would be no community-minded constraints on my natural impulse to bonk your head and commandeer the desired soup, since... The poor Canadian is outside the equation of poursuivre labeneur of each individual, since he is not a part of the community whose environment of mutual respect I depend on for pursuing my interest of maximal pleasure to pain.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.